let's start with what's going on right now in Ukraine, in Avdiivka. How do you see the battlefield right now, and what is the importance of Avdiivka for Russians?
Well, I mean, what we're seeing right now throughout the entire line of contact is the collapse of the cohesion of the Ukrainian military to sustain a viable battlefield presence. You know, they lack artillery ammunition, and they lack the ability to replace their lack of artillery ammunition with an alternative such as drones on isolated areas of the battlefield. The Ukrainians have sought to, you know, swarm drones and, you know, to disrupt the Russian attack. But the Russians have come up with a counter, you know, which is basically to hunt down the drone operators. And right now, I think one of the most dangerous jobs in Ukraine is to be a drone operator because you're marked for death. Without fire support, the Ukrainian infantry and armor is very vulnerable to Russian artillery fires, Russian drone strikes, and this is what we're seeing. The battle for Avdiivka is an indicator of this. The Ukrainians were able to use artillery to disrupt Russia's attacks by not only striking troop concentrations, but also command and control facilities, logistics, but more importantly, to prevent the Russians from massing artillery fires, so that whatever artillery Russia brought up tended to get caught up in, you know, counter battery artillery duels, things of that nature. Now that Ukraine has pretty much seen its artillery removed from the battlefield, Russia is able to mass artillery fires and bring about an extraordinary amount of destruction on Ukrainian forces. And the end result is Russia is making very dramatic gains. It looks as if the city of Avdiivka is about to fall. And with it, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers will be killed, wounded, or captured. And this will rip a very giant hole in the Ukrainian defenses, a hole that previously had been seen as an anchor, this impregnable fortress around which the Ukrainians could, you know, anchor their defenses. Now that the fortress has fallen, the Ukrainians not only have lost this fortified position, but they've lost the troops, the tens of thousands of troops they had committed to this battle. And there's a hole in the line. There will be a hole in the line that the Russians will seek to exploit. And the Ukrainians won't have forces able to fill this hole. Whatever they throw in aren't going to be reserves from the rear area. There'll be forces stripped away from other fronts where they're desperately needed. And this just creates more opportunity for the Russians, who will continue to press forward on the attack. And the situation will just get worse for the Ukrainians, because everywhere on the battlefield, they lack artillery support. Everywhere on the battlefield, the Russians are able to mass artillery fires and inflict tremendous casualties on the Ukrainians, casualties the Ukrainians can't replace. So it's the beginning of the end. We're looking at the total collapse of the Ukrainian army's ability to resist.
Is the West willing or able to provide Ukraine with artillery?
The answer is, you know, twofold. Willing, apparently not. They're not doing anything. But even if they had the will, where are they going to get the ammunition? It just doesn't grow on trees. It has to be produced. And Europe has acknowledged that they were unable to generate the industrial capacity to produce ammunition you know, in the amounts needed by the Ukrainians. But even if they pass money today, for instance, the U.S. Congress kicks out money, you know, this ammunition still has to be produced. It in some cases would require production lines to be built. We're talking about months before any ammunition could be flowing to Ukraine. It's questionable whether the Ukrainian military will still be able to exist in months' time. So they're suffering catastrophic losses on the battlefield, losses that can't be replaced. And there's no amount of money that can plug that hole.
We've heard during this war, we've heard about the NATO's or the United States high-tech weapons being used in Ukraine that were not suitable for this kind of fight, this kind of war of attrition in Ukraine. Do you think in the U.S., the military-industrial complex is thinking of modifying these kind of systems?
First of all, I don't agree with this concept. I think a weapon system that's placed in the hands of personnel who are trained to use it and who have logistical sustainability, who have tactics and operations geared around the specifications of this equipment will do well in battle. You know, I just have to, I believe that the United States Army using the M1 tank would perform better than the Ukrainian Army using the M1 tank. It's not about the tank. It's about the soldier. It's about the system. It's about the approach. You know, but the U.S. Army would run into, you know, similar problems, you know, artillery support. You know, does the U.S. Army have sufficient artillery systems capable to, you know, match or, in the case of the need for victory, surpass those of Russia? And the answer is no. Can we sustain our brigades in combat for a meaningful period of time? The answer is no. It's not about the equipment. I mean, we know that good soldiers with outdated equipment can do quite well. We saw this, you know, in Israel's 1956, 1967, even 1973 war, wars against their Arab opponents. Many of the Israeli reserve units that were sent into battle were sent to the battle with old tanks, some of the tanks dating back to World War II. But through audacity, through good tactics, et cetera, Israel was able to prevail. And so if the Ukrainian army, you know, had its act together, you know, had highly trained troops, it doesn't matter that they don't have the newest tanks. Now, there is an argument to be made that since the Ukrainian military was trained on Soviet-era equipment, that it would be best to give them Soviet-era equipment. And I agree with that. One of the big problems here is that we're giving them equipment that they can't maintain, that they aren't familiar with. They don't know how to use. They don't know its characteristics. They don't have maintenance sustainability. But again, that's not the equipment's fault. That's the Ukrainian soldiers' fault. They're just not able to receive this equipment and use this equipment effectively.
When it comes to the Patriot systems and S-300, which is much older than Patriot systems, how do you compare these two kind of systems that were so crucial in this battle in Ukraine?
Again, it comes down to troops. I mean, the Patriot system, first of all, isn't as good as everybody makes it out to be. It's based upon a flawed concept of automated engagement, you know, that dates back to the safeguard system of the 1970s. You know, we took a strategic defense system, you know, the concepts, and we tried to create this tactical system that didn't work when we've been struggling with it since the beginning. In 1991, during the Gulf War, we saw the Patriot was not effective in intercepting Iraqi modified Scud missiles. We've seen in Saudi Arabia the Patriot not being able to defend strategic locations, and we see in Ukraine that the Patriot just isn't the magic system everybody makes out to be. So, you know, we have that. The S-300 is a tested system, but it's an old system. It's one that the Russians are very familiar with. What I can say is that you know, the problems faced by these two systems isn't necessarily a failure of the system, but the fact that the Russians just happen to be very good at suppressing enemy air defense, and they've come up with the appropriate tactics to overwhelm Ukraine's air defense, because Ukraine has other systems, the Iris-T, the NASAMS. None of these systems are working. None of these systems are keeping the Russians from dominating the skies over Ukraine.
When it comes to the production of ammunition, what's the problem that they cannot produce at the same level that Russia does today?
Problem is greed. Look, the United States has the ability to create modern production facilities, and we have the ability to generate large quantities of ammunition. That's not the problem. The problem is that that's very expensive, and the defense industries don't want to engage in activities that minimize their profit margin. They have a way of doing business today that is geared exclusively to making money for their shareholders, and they don't want to deviate from that. Look, the United States could, you know, we saw this during COVID, where the president used special defense production laws to get companies to gear up for the production of ventilators and other things that were deemed to be in the national security interest. The president hasn't used any of those powers when it comes to producing artillery ammunition. They've put out bids, they've made requests, but the defense industries themselves are saying, you know, we need contracts of a certain size, a certain duration. We're not going to go out and put up a new production line just to crank out a million rounds and then have to shut it down because the war in Ukraine was over. And the U.S. government's not willing to make that commitment. So the end result is the defense industries refuse to do that which is necessary to increase artillery shell production, et cetera. We go to Russia, and what we see is that the Russian government makes a determination that they need defense industry geared up, and because the defense industry is largely under state control, they do operate under a concept called joint stock companies, and so there is a civilian commercial element. But when it comes to the defense industry, they're responsible to the defense minister and the ministries, you know, of defense industry, and they're held to account. They produce that which is needed in the interest of national security. They're not worried about the bottom line. They're not worried about stockholders, shareholders. They're worried about getting the material to the Russian military of a time of a certain quality and in a certain time frame. Two totally different approaches.
We know about these tensions that are getting worse between Zelensky and Zaluzhny. Recently, Victoria Nuland was there in Kiev. And how much of this visit was about this conflict between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, and how much of it was about the next step in this conflict in Ukraine, how they gonna respond to Russia? What would be the next step?
Well, I think they're one and the same. First of all, the issue of Zaluzhny apparently has been resolved. In the last hour, it appears that Zelensky has, in fact, relieved Zaluzhny and replaced him with another Ukrainian general. And so this the implication in that is that a solution was found to where Zaluzhny would step aside, that he wouldn't oppose the resignation. He wouldn't, have the potential of launching a military coup to remove Zelensky from power. It also means that Zelensky and the new military leadership and the new civilian leadership, because my understanding is that Zaluzhny's departure is not a one of, that there will be other people within the Ukrainian government that will be asked to step aside, that they have a common strategy they can agree upon. I think Zelensky was saying that, you must have confidence in victory, and that he says that Zaluzhny had lost confidence in victory. So he's surrounding himself with people that share, his policy positions, which lend themselves towards, an aggressive posture, non-submissive posture. But it's a posture that's predicated upon continued support by the United States and Europe. And right now, especially in the United States, that support isn't forthcoming. But I think Victoria Nuland's visit was designed to ensure that Ukraine didn't devolve in a way that ended the pretense of Ukraine being a democracy. You see, civil military relations is very important in a democracy. When a civilian leader says something or gives an order to the military leader has to obey, especially when they're told to step aside. Zaluzhny disobeyed. He was told to step aside and he refused to do so. And so if Zelensky had pushed this issue, the potential of a coup d'etat existed. So I think Victoria Nuland's job was to come in and try to navigate a solution that would not result in a military coup, and that would result in Zelensky being able to consolidate power amongst people who shared his vision on how this war should be conducted.
Is Odessa still on the table to be saved for Ukrainians?
No, I don't believe so. I think the decision has been made in Russia that Odessa, Mykolaiv, Dnepropetrovsk, and Kharkov will be removed from Ukrainian control and placed under Russian control. Whether this is permanent or part of a buffer zone might be up for negotiation, any post-conflict discussion. But no, Ukraine will be defeated. They will be demilitarized. They will be denazified. And Russia, I believe, is going to take control of the territories that it it believes constitute part of historic Russia, and that includes Odessa, Mykolaiv, Dnepropetrovsk, Kharkov, in addition to Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk.
With what we've seen so far, in your opinion, if that happens, what would be the situation of the western part of Ukraine? We know that we have various ethnicities in that part, Romanians, Hungarians. How do you see the future of the western part of Ukraine if it ends up to be a landlocked?
I think Russia has to be careful not to win the war, but lose the war. And what I mean by that is the whole purpose of this special military operation was to make sure that there was a neutral Ukraine, that NATO couldn't use Ukraine as a springboard against Russia, etc. And also to create the conditions for a new European security framework discussion with Europe and the United States. If this war ends and Western Ukraine continues to be a place where anti-Russian ideology can fester and be fostered, where Stepan Bandera is still considered to be a hero, then what has Russia accomplished? Nothing. I mean, they've won a war, they've gained some territories, but this problem hasn't gone away and it will continue to exist. I think Russia wants this problem to be ended. It wants the issue of Bandera's ideology to be terminated. And so this is going to require not allowing Western Ukraine to fall under the sovereign control of other nations, but for Russia to ensure that Western Ukraine is purged of all of its Banderist leanings, and and cleanse it of this infection. And then afterwards, to incorporate this cleansed Western Ukraine into whatever Ukrainian rump state still exists after the conflict. Belarus has made it clear that it will not tolerate Western Ukraine going to Poland, that poses an existential threat. So, and I think Russia will respect Belarus's inclinations in this regard. So I don't see Western Ukraine going to Poland. Now there are other ethnic groups. Romania has some claims, Hungary has some claims. On here, I could see referenda taking place that saw the transfer, because we're not talking about Nazi ideology. We're talking about respecting the desires of the for self-determination of an ethnically homogenous people. So the Hungarians would say, we don't want to live under Ukraine. We want to live in Hungary. The same thing with the Romanians. So I think we could see that. But for Western Ukraine, I don't see Russia allowing that to go to Poland. First of all, it would insult Belarus, and put the Belarus-Russian relationship at risk. And second of all, it creates the conditions where eventually Western Ukraine could be absorbed by Poland, therefore becoming NATO territory. Or the Banderists would never be purged, and they would be there continuing to spread their rot. So I don't see a situation where Russia allows Western Ukraine to become an independent entity.
In Germany, in the United Kingdom, recently in Sweden, they're talking about fighting Russia. How realistic is that?
I think right now NATO is in a crisis. They have said that the conflict in Ukraine is existential for them, that they can't allow Russia to win. Well, Russia's winning. It doesn't matter what NATO wants or thinks or desires. Russia is not only winning, but Russia has won. And so NATO is now struggling to make itself relevant. And it can only do that by postulating scenarios where there will be conflict with Russia, because only by postulating those scenarios can they argue for the increase in defense spending that would be necessary to rebuild the alliance militarily. The good news is that every single one of the NATO war narratives involves Russia attacking NATO, and Russia is not going to attack NATO. But what NATO needs to realize is, regardless of whether it's a Russian attack or a NATO attack or whatever, a war with Russia will not be anything like the conflict that we see in Ukraine. I mean, right now, NATO is under the impression that that's the war they'll be fighting. That's why they're talking about, a 300,000 person rapid response force, rearming, re-equipping, etc. They're doing this large exercise this summer. So, but the The war between Russia and NATO won't be done fought by conventional means. It'll be fought using nuclear weapons. And General Medvedev, Dmitry Medvedev, the former prime minister and former president of Russia, currently deputy head of the Russian National Security Council, has said that if there's a war with NATO, basically Russia will use nuclear weapons and destroy NATO, destroy everything about it, destroy every city. That's the reality of a Russian-NATO conflict. The good news again is that NATO's, war rhetoric is predicated upon a Russian attack against NATO that will never come. So it's basically loud words. But the problem is, if NATO continues to not only posture rhetorically about the potential of conflict, but begins to actively prepare for potential of conflict, you could create a scenario where one mistake, one miscalculation leads to the initiation of action that then results in a war that nobody wanted, nobody was looking for, but now is here, and now everybody dies. So that's the danger. And I think the world needs to wake up, not just Ukraine, and not just Europe, not just Russia, not just the United States, but the world, that what NATO is doing is grossly irresponsible and putting the entire world at risk. And maybe international pressure could be put on NATO so that it stops talking about the need to expand its military capacity and instead starts talking about, what it takes to create a new European security framework where Russia, NATO, Russia, and Europe can live side by side in peace.
Many people are arguing that if NATO goes to war with Russia, they're gonna smash Russia because they're comparing GDP of these countries, the size of military, the weapons, the manpower they have.
Well, first of all, again, if NATO and Russia fight, understand it doesn't matter how much conventional power you have. It's going to be a nuclear war, so you're all going to die. And NATO has no meaningful nuclear capacity. They rely on the United States, to a lesser extent, France and Great Britain. So it's a stupid argument to begin with, a stupid conversation to begin with. But it's there. I recognize that. But let's just look at the fallacy of this. NATO is not a singularity. It's not a homogeneous singularity. What I mean by that is, in the United States, I can take a division from Washington State and move it to Georgia and then move it on to Europe, because America is a singularity. How many Spanish divisions are there, and how many of those divisions are earmarked to fight in Poland? First answer is, I don't know. We'd have to look it up. But the second answer is easy, zero. So let's take Spain out of the equation in any potential future conflict with Russia. There won't be any Spanish forces in Poland. How about Portuguese forces? Nope, none of them either. How about Italians? Nope. How about the Turks? Nope. How about the Greeks? Nope. Do you see what I'm saying? It doesn't matter how many nations are in NATO. NATO is incapable of harnessing the totality of this military potential into a singularity capable of standing up to Russia. If Russia and NATO were to get engaged in a ground combat, it would be either in Northern Europe with Poland, the Baltic states, backed up to a lesser extent by the United States, very small British contingent, very small French contingent, and maybe some German troops. But there won't be any Italians, there won't be any Spanish, there won't be any Portuguese, there won't be any Turks or Greeks. Just those forces, and those nations all have broken militaries that are incapable of generating militarily significant forces. So that's right. Now let's say we fight against the fights now in Moldova and in Romania. So you have the Romanian army. You may get some Bulgarians, probably not, but maybe some. You'll get some Americans, and that's it. The rest of NATO is not going to deploy to Romania. So, what are we talking about here? It's NATO's power exists only on paper. It's not like there's a single NATO military. The military is made up of a bunch of constituent states, each one of whom, have their own commitments. You can't look at the Spanish military and say, oh, because they have 500,000 troops, they can send 500,000 troops to Poland. They have other commitments. They have other national security requirements. So even if they were able to deploy people to Poland, I would imagine they could only generate a couple thousand. That's not game-changing numbers. So the people that talk about NATO being this unbeatable force just don't know what they're talking about.
Putin and Lavrov, they're thinking of negotiations. They were always talking about negotiations to solve the situation, the problem in Ukraine. But in order to have that, we need somebody in the United States, in Washington, who's willing to do that.
Well, I think it's pretty arrogant to think that the United States is going to play a role in negotiating an outcome to this conflict. The United States is a party to the conflict. And they're the side they've chosen is the losing side. What makes anybody think that Russia wants to sit down at the table with the United States or Europe to resolve the issue in Ukraine? Russia tried that already. They tried that in 2022. And it was the United States and England, together with NATO and the European and Europe, that advised Ukraine not to agree to a peace treaty. Now Russia has mobilized. Russia has spent a significant amount of money. They've lost many troops, and victory is theirs. Why would they negotiate that away? What is Russia going to negotiate? They want denazification. That means the end of the Zelensky regime. So they're not going to negotiate with the Zelensky. They want demilitarization, which means the destruction of this pro-NATO army that NATO was built on the soil of Ukraine. Russia's not going to negotiate that away. This war will end when Russia puts forward unconditional terms of surrender that Ukraine will have no choice but to accept. And then the West will have to live with that. Whatever negotiations take place between the West and Russia will take place after Russia defeats Ukraine, after Russia imposes its will on the Ukrainian situation, not before. Why would they sit down and negotiate? That's a defeat. In order to get Russia to the negotiating table, you have to beat Russia. Nobody's beating Russia right now.
I talked with Chas Freeman, Ambassador Chas Freeman. He said that the future of Europe without Russia doesn't mean anything. They need Russia for energy, and industry in Europe needs Russia to be part of their prosperity. In your opinion, how realistic is that?
It's the only outcome. You know, we're seeing a situation where the European people are starting to recognize that they've been taken hostage by their own politicians who don't have the best interests of Europe or the people, you know, at heart. So we're seeing farmers come out in great numbers. We're seeing the people becoming disillusioned by the electorate. And, you know, when businessmen sit down and say, under what conditions, for instance, in Germany, can businesses return to Germany? It'll be cheap energy. Right now, they can't afford it because the United States scammed Europe. We blew up a pipeline, and then we convinced them to stop importing energy. And then they had to turn to us, and they're paying exorbitant prices for gas. And you know, the Europeans, that's not sustainable. I think the Europeans will make a decision down the road that there needs to be a new European security framework that allows them to peacefully coexist with Russia. It may be a framework that operates inside the NATO alliance or outside the NATO alliance. It's not going to be dependent upon that. It's going to be dependent upon the desire of the participants for renewed relations, good relations with Russia, inclusive of the ability of Europe to procure Russian energy at affordable prices.
Scott, when you look at Germany, we know that the Green Party is not in a good shape right now. An alternative for this party would be AfD, that is getting a stronger alternative for Germany, for Deutschland. The leader of this party was talking about Dexit that comes from Brexit. When it comes to the problems that they're dealing with right now, how serious is this kind of mindset?
I would imagine that's still a minority position because Germany has played such an important role in the creation of the European Union, and the German economy is at the center of the Euro economy. Before Germany divorces itself from Europe, I think that Germany would seek a rethinking about NATO and the role that NATO plays and the role that Germany plays in NATO. As a way of strengthening Europe, because I think there's a growing recognition inside Germany that NATO actually is being used by the United States to tear Europe apart, to weaken Europe. And so I think the first thing that would happen would be for Germany to turn its back on NATO before Germany turns its back on the European Union, because That would require Germany to go alone. And this would also be a huge threat to Europe, because if Germany goes alone, it means it's going in a direction opposite of that which is desired by the United States or Brussels, which means they're probably going to gravitate towards Russia and become some sort of economic partner with Russia. And that would create significant problems for both Europe and the United States.
How is that possible for Europe to be independent and a powerhouse?
I think it's I think to talk about Europe as a powerhouse is unrealistic. Europe's had its moment. The European Union was created. Europe was given an opportunity to build something strong, and yet all they ended up subordinating themselves to the United States. Today, Europe has too many problems. Europe will break apart into its constituent states, I believe. That's the future of Europe. But the notion of this powerful united Europe is a joke. It's a fallacy. It's not powerful, and it's definitely not united. Another problem facing Europe is that because of this multi-decade experiment in creating a European community, people stopped believing in their own national identity. And that's problematic. You have people that probably can't articulate what it means to be a Frenchman, what it means to be a German, what it means to be a Brit. They just know what it means to live in Europe. We'll see what the future holds. I think rise of parties like the Alternative for Deutschland are reflective of the fact that many people, Michel Le Pen has a right-wing party in France. We're seeing Giorgia Moreno, the Italian prime minister, she's from the right, Viktor Orban. We're seeing the rise politically of right-wing parties that talk about defending sovereignty, national sovereignty, not European sovereignty. So I think we're seeing Europe redefine itself as a collective of nation states, as opposed to nation states that have come together in a European singularity. I don't see Europe emerging as a powerhouse, and I don't see any European nation being able to, in a reasonable period of time, reverse the deindustrialization that's taking place now because of the sanction of Russia and the kickback. I think Europe has shot itself in the foot, and it's going to have to restructure and redefine itself before it can emerge with any sort of viable economy. And a key aspect of this restructuring and redefinition will, of course, be its energy relationship with Russia.
With the damage that we're witnessing that they're having in their relations with Russia right now, in your opinion, how long does it take to get to the point before this war started?
I don't think we'll ever get to the point before this war started. The world's changed. Before this war started, Russia was talking to NATO to create a new European security framework. After this war finishes, Russia will have defeated NATO and won't be inclined to give NATO the same consideration that it gave to NATO prior to this war. The same with the United States. I think we're looking at a completely new European-Russian relationship, one that where Europe has to respect the strength of Russia. Back in December of 2021, Europe ignored the Russian outreach for a new European security framework because they didn't respect Russia. They didn't fear Russia. They viewed Russia as a joke. A nation, a gas station disguised as a nation, things of this nature. Well, Russia has emerged from this conflict, having defined itself as not just a regional powerhouse, but a global powerhouse with unmatched military skills and an economy that's booming compared to Europe's economy. Russia's not going to give away everything that it has accrued in a positive fashion over the course of the past 2 years, just to have good relations with Europe. I think that Europe is going to have to redefine its relationship with Russia based upon respect of Russia and a respect of Russia's sovereignty and a respect for Russian national security prerogatives when it comes to spheres of influence in Europe.
I talked with Professor Richard Wolff and Michael Hodson. They were talking about the reason behind this war in Ukraine was the reason that the West had against Soviet Union. They wrecked the economy of Soviet Union by forcing them, by convincing them to put a lot of money in their military industrial complex. So the economy of Soviet Union collapsed. But they were not successful in this policy in Ukraine, and Russia could manage the military part and the economy. You've been in Russia recently. How did you find this?
Well, I'm not an economist and I don't want to play one. So I have to be careful about, getting too far outside of my lane. What I can say is this, though. The Soviet Union suffered from, centralized planning. If we take a look at their ballistic missile production, they produced very good missiles and they produced a lot of missiles, but the mechanism was of pain. The economy of producing missiles wasn't something that the West could readily comprehend. It wasn't that the factory received money for the missile. Like if I contract with Boeing to produce a missile, we have a price marked for each missile. And that price generates funding that then gets budgeted and used to pay salaries, build infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. That's not how it worked for there. There was a whole bunch of factors that went in that didn't have direct economic correlations. And so it was unsustainable, especially when the Soviet economy tried to transition away from centralized planning into, more cost-effective cost accounting, where they had to account for each dollar, where to go to traditional Western-style accounting. And what they found when they made that transition is, you couldn't sustain the factory city. One of the things about the Soviet Union is when they produced these missiles in Votkinsk, where I was, the factory was responsible for schooling, for the roads, for housing, for social things. So the budget that they received from the state didn't just pay for the missiles, they paid for everything. When you went over to Costa County, suddenly you're paying for a missile, but there's no money for everything else. So the system started to collapse. So it wasn't that the West caused Russia to collapse. That's just not true. The Soviet Union could very well, there's a school of thought today that that the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed is because Mikhail Gorbachev precipitously transitioned from Soviet-style economy to a Western-style economy with no plan on how to do it, and the whole thing collapsed. Had he continued the Soviet style planning, but sought to tighten it up, make things better, not make a direct model of a Western capitalism, there wouldn't have been this precipitous collapse. But he didn't have that vision. He had bought into the notion that the West was better. And next thing you know, you have Boris Yeltsin, the decade of the 90s, and the absolute devastation of Russia because of this. If you take a look at Russian capitalism today, it's a totally different concept, but it's not American capitalism. It's something different. The Russians have a unique economy today, but what's interesting is the West has no clue how the Russian economy works, just like we had no clue how the Soviet economy works. I'm just being straight up honest. The CIA had no clue how the Soviet economy worked. They were just guessing. This is why people like Jeffrey Sachs, who went into Russia in the 1990s, couldn't grasp, what he was trying to fix, because he was coming in with a Western economic planning model that did not translate into the reality of Russia. Russia has emerged from the 1990s. They had to deal with some new artificialities, the rise of an oligarch class that didn't exist during Soviet times had to be factored in. The saving grace here is that when the West sanctioned Russia in 2022, it was a full divorce. And it forced Russia to do things that politically would have been very difficult to do, like untangle the West from Russian economy, to shut down the oligarchs, to insist on the reinvestment of money in Russia. The West doesn't know Russia's economy today. I mean, I keep telling people that you need to go to the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum every year. So you get an understanding of what makes the Russian economy tick. Nobody wants to go because that's Russian propaganda. No, it's Russian reality. There was an exhibition, I think it's still on for a couple more weeks, the VDHE exhibition in Moscow, that talks about the economic status of all the various districts and republics and oblasts. Each one had their own exhibition platform. And I toured that, and you get to see the diversity of the Russian economy. Again, if you don't see it, you don't know it, you can't talk about it, you can't assess it. And I think that I think we put too much, we've created a myth about the collapse of the Soviet economy. It didn't collapse the way they say it did. I would challenge them on that. I think that it's far more complicated than just saying that we put so much pressure on them in terms of producing weapons that the system collapsed. No. The system was there. It was working. It wasn't firing on all cylinders. The problem was trying to transition that system to Western-style capitalism. That's where the collapse took place, not because we put too much pressure on Russia. And today, the notion that we could pressure Russia, how do you pressure a system that you don't understand? I mean, what points of pressure are you going to push? You know, it makes no sense. We're going to sanction the Russian economy. One of the reasons why sanctions have failed is because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know the Russian economy. They don't know how it functions. They have artificial expectations about, you know, if we cause effect relations, if we do this, this will happen. Well, we did this, that didn't happen, but it backfired on us. I would say that most economists today don't have a clue what the reality of the Russian economy is. I don't have a complete picture of it, but I've, you know, my host that takes me to Russia is a Russian economist. And he spent a lot of time introducing me to the reality of the Russian economy, not just in Moscow, St. Petersburg, but throughout in Novosibirsk, in Irkutsk, Ekaterinburg, Izhevsk, Kazan. And you see the reality of the complexity, the diversity of this Russian economy. You know, there are weaknesses, there are strengths, but my point is we in the West don't understand it because we've divorced ourselves from Russia. We study Russia from afar through a filter that's defined by Western academics who are inherently opposed to Russia, therefore paint everything that happens in Russia in a negative light. Russia is a far stronger economy today than even the IMF, which is supposed to be very good at global economy. They can't get it right. They set a number for the Russian economy for economic growth, and they came back and said, well, we got to increase it because they don't understand what's happening. They don't understand what's happening. So I think it's too simple to say, you know, we did X for the Soviet Union, this happened, but when we tried to do it with Russia, it didn't happen. You can't make those correlations. Two totally different economic problems, but both united by the fact that the West had no clue what was really going on inside either the Soviet economy or the Russian economy today.
How do they feel about these new oblasts of the eastern part of Ukraine? Do they really think that they are part of Russia? I'm talking about the public in Russia.
There's no doubt in their minds that they're part of Russia. There's no debate, there's no discussion, there's no dialogue. They are Russia. And Russia views them as Russia. This isn't a joke. This isn't a game. This isn't some sort of geopolitical cuteness. Russia went to war. Russia didn't want Zaporizhia. They didn't want Kherson. They may have wanted it, but they didn't desire to take it from Ukraine. But they were compelled to do so. And now that they have done so, these territories are part of Russia. I was in Kherson. I interviewed the governor. I interviewed the head of their economic development. They are rebuilding that place as this war goes on, so that it is a functional part of Russia. There's no debating this. In the West, we can sit there and play stupid games by drawing lines on maps saying we don't recognize that. Russia doesn't care. Drive into Kherson and ask them, are you Russian or are you Ukrainian? There's no debate, no discussion. They're Russian. They will always be Russian, forever in perpetuity.
how they're helping them right now, because they were so devastated, these regions were so devastated by this war.
Well, I mean, in Kherson, the first investment project that was put in place was the construction of a concrete manufacturing plant, one line. They now have six lines. I think the plant was designed at, to produce concrete at a rate of 60 cubic meters per hour. You have six lines. That's six times six, 360 cubic meters of concrete per hour. I'm not a construction specialist, but that's a lot of concrete. And they're producing it and they're pouring it, which means they're building stuff. So I think I just answered your question.
They were part of Ukraine for years, and right now they're going to be part of Russia. How do you find these differences between these two? Is there anything different from what you've seen in Russia and what you've seen in the eastern part of Ukraine? Culturally, traditionally?
Well, first of all, there is no such thing as the eastern part of Ukraine. Let's just correct the record. There's the new Russian territories. There is no eastern Ukraine. Doesn't exist. Finished. Now, I mean, there's people out there that'll, for political reasons, talk about it, but it doesn't exist. Physically, it doesn't exist. There is no eastern Ukraine. Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk are part of Russia forever. It will never change. So we shouldn't talk about eastern Ukraine. Could talk about the new territories. But let's understand this, that even there was never really a viable Ukraine to begin with. When we speak of Ukraine during the Soviet times, it wasn't an independent entity. It was part of the Soviet Union, which was in effect part of Greater Russia. Moscow was dictating outcomes. Kiev was a regional capital that received orders from Moscow. And everybody worked together towards the common good. You had, I mean, when you look at the leadership of the Soviet Union, Brezhnev was a Ukrainian. He ruled for 18 years. Khrushchev's wife was Ukrainian. He identified as Ukrainian. He ruled for 10 years. So for 28 years, the Soviet Union was ruled by Ukrainians. But they didn't say that. They were ruled by Soviets. The senior officers in the Russian and Ukrainian military today all trained together in the same academies. They didn't view themselves as Ukrainian or Russian. They viewed themselves as Soviet, which means part of Greater Russia. Everybody who lives in the Eastern Territories, who speaks Russian, practices Russian Orthodox faith, never viewed themselves as Ukrainian. They always viewed themselves as Russia. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and Ukraine became an independent state, these people never said, "Oh, I'm with Kiev." They always said, "No, I'm Russian. I'm with Moscow." That's just the reality of it. Now, they had to live with a political reality that, you know, they were part of Ukraine from a sovereign standpoint, but they continued to fight for their rights, fight, struggle for the right to speak Russian. You know, everybody talks about the 2014 Maidan coup that took place, but the real coup when it comes to the split between what's Ukraine and Russia was in 2005 during the Orange Revolution. That was the first nationalist coup d'etat where the nationalists came in who started to promote you know, this Ukrainian national identity. The president at that time you know, elevated Stepan Bandera into a national hero. And they began to attack Russian speakers, Russian culture, et cetera. That's where you started to see the first divided. Because prior to that, I just interviewed Nikolai Azarov, who was the former prime minister of Ukraine. He said prior to that, prior to the Velvet Revolution, there was no talk about Russians and Ukrainians. We lived together, we worked together, we worked towards a common goal, et cetera. It was only after the Velvet Revolution that we started to. You see the split. And when the Ukrainian nationalists, who were now empowered, started attacking the Russians, they compelled the Russians to start viewing themselves as Russian. And then, therefore, now there's a split between them and Ukraine, and they started looking to Russia for help to defend them. At the same time that the Velvet Revolution took place, you know, President Putin gave a speech in the Federal Assembly in 2005. It's a speech where he said, that the greatest, one of the greatest, you know, catastrophes of the last century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And everybody picked up on that speech saying, aha, he wants to return to Soviet times. No, if you know anything about Putin, anything about the Russians, no, they didn't want that. Because what he said next is what's important, because overnight, millions of Russians became homeless. And those homeless included the Russians of Ukraine. At the time he gave that speech, Russians were being attacked in Ukraine for the crime of being Russian. And he said, my job as the Russian president, as the president, is the president of the Russian nation. And the Russian nation is not defined by the borders of the Russian Federation. The Russian nation is defined by a people united in shared history, shared culture, shared language, shared religion, which means he was responsible for the well-being of these Russians, these ethnic Russians in Ukraine, in the Baltic states, and in Kazakhstan, elsewhere. He was responsible for their safety, for their protection. So the idea that this pro-Russian sentiment that's in the eastern Ukraine, it's not artificial. It's real. They've always viewed themselves as Russian. And to the extent that they've been separated from Ukraine, it's the Ukrainian government's fault. It wasn't Russia coming in trying to strip them away. In fact, if you take a look at the Minsk Accords in 2014, the Donbas, Donetsk, Lugansk, the separatists wanted to become part of Russia, and Putin said, no, you're part of Ukraine. So, from a sovereign standpoint, you're part of Ukraine. Prior to 2014, when the right sector made a grab to seize Crimea and seize the port facilities in Sevastopol, Russia viewed Crimea as part of Ukraine. They didn't like that. The Russians that lived there said, we're Russian. But from a legal standpoint, Russia was not making an effort to strip these territories away. They only took control of these territories when the Ukrainian nationalists started to threaten the security of the Russian people living there. Then the Russian president of the Russian nation said, it's my duty and responsibility to protect these people. Until the West understands that and respects that, then we'll never, we'll just never be able to be in sync with Russia. And the reality is that the Russian nation today includes Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnepropetrovsk, and Kharkov. And you probably call that Eastern Ukraine today because that's the easternmost part, but it won't be Eastern Ukraine much longer. It will be part of the new Russian territories because this war, I don't believe, will end until those territories are incorporated into Russia as well.
I think the picture that you've just drawn for us totally describes why Russia calls it special military operation, because it's not anything like what we've seen in Gaza.
I know it's a meme because but it showed a photograph of Kiev today and compared it to a photograph of Gaza. And he said, this is Kiev at war. This is Gaza at war. Now, you can replace Kiev with the photograph of Bakhmut, a photograph of Mariupol, a photograph of Avdiivka, and you'll see totally destroyed cities. So it's sort of a cute, too cute to be true. I mean, but the point is, Kiev is the capital of Ukraine, and it functions today as if there wasn't a war. Yes, every once in a while, electric power goes out. But, the notion that you can have a functioning parliament, that you can have a president unscathed, you can have foreign leaders hostile to Russia's interests traveling freely to Kiev and walking around and seeing things is absurd. If this was a war, Kiev would be flattened. And that's the reality. It is a special military operation. Russia is waging this conflict in a manner that is totally different from war, because Russia knows that one day this war will end and that it will have to deal with what's left. And it would rather deal with a Ukraine that could be rapidly reconstituted as a viable nation state with infrastructure that functioned, as opposed to a totally devastated nation that becomes a burden to Russia going forward.
Germany and Japan signed a military pact to contain China. What's the reason behind this, in your opinion?
I think it's primarily involved in the sharing of defense technology and things of that nature. Germany can't deploy troops. They can deploy a reinforced battalion to Lithuania. They're talking about expanding that to a brigade, but that's going to create a crisis within the German military in terms of sustainability. What German forces are going to go to the aid of Japan? None. Zero. What Japanese forces are going to come to the aid of Germany? None. Zero. It's a meaningless document. It's a political document. It's a document to make up for the fact that at the last NATO summit, France vetoed the notion of NATO setting up an office in Japan. So what Germany's doing is recognizing that while NATO can't be in Japan, that it will enter into relations so that it can be shown that NATO and Japan through the German action are cooperating with each other. But you know, if Japan gets dragged into an American conflict with China over Taiwan, Germany will not be coming to the assistance of Japan.
When you look at this kind of actions together with the tensions that you're witnessing in Taiwan, the United States and United Kingdom were asking China to help them to talk with Iranians. When you look at all these equations, what's the logic behind this?
What I see is incompetence, and what I see is a Biden administration that's reacting to global events, not being proactive. We have a China policy. The policy deals with economically isolating or weakening China, and also strengthening our ties with Taiwan to facilitate eventual independence of Taiwan. Even though we claim that we support a one China policy, we don't. So we have these policies. We're confronted with certain realities, like we don't have sufficient force to recapture the 12-dash line or 9-dash line, the islands in the South Pacific. We're not able to sustain a military presence in the Straits of Taiwan. So we know what the reality is, but our policy is one of aggression. And we can't change that. So now we come in the situation with the Houthi, and we want the Chinese to do something for us and say, we'd like your help. And China's like, why would I do this? Chinese ships aren't being interdicted, just your ships. What's in it for me? Diplomacy is the art of the two-way street. It just seems absurd that that we somehow think China would come to our assistance, vis-a-vis the Houthi, and while at the same time we continue policies designed to isolate, undermine, and defeat China. We need to get our act together and stop looking at defeating people, especially militarily, and start looking about competing with people economically and diplomatically. We might have more luck, because everything we're doing right now is a failure.
Talking about the Red Sea and what's going on, how did you find this operation so far? How successful was that in controlling Houthis?
It's a total failure, abject failure. The purpose is to establish deterrence so that the Houthi will be deterred from continuing their action. Well, they haven't been deterred. All it's done is expose the reality that the United States cannot keep open one of the strategic waterways of the world, the Bab el-Mandeb. And what's the lesson from this? The United States won't be able to keep the Strait of Hormuz open as well. So any expanded conflict drags in Iran, means that Iran will shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and we're helpless. We can't stop that. And now the global economy will be strangled. So I don't see a situation where what the United States is doing is benefited it in any way, shape, or form. Rather than bombing, we should have turned to diplomacy. And the quickest way out of the predicament that we've created for ourselves isn't to bomb people into submission, but to engage about an equitable solution to the Palestinian problem, to bring an end to the fighting between Israel and Hamas. If you do that, the other problems tend to solve themselves. But if you're going to continue to go all in on the side of Israel, understand that there will be consequences to pay. And we don't have the military force to effectively deter those consequences.
When it comes to dealing with Houthis, with all of these groups in the Middle East, they're talking about Iran. Iran is the core of these problems. Lindsey Graham and other Republican senators were talking about bombing Iran. If they bomb Iran, they can solve the problems in the Middle East?
No, I mean, if by bombing Iran we could solve the problems in the Middle East, we would have bombed Iran a long time ago. The reason why we don't bomb Iran is that it won't solve the problems in the Middle East. It'll just make the problems even greater. Not only that, but there's no guarantee that we win any conflict with Iran. We know that Iran will be able to inflict near fatal economic damage on the United States and the world by shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, and if necessary, destroying the oil production infrastructure of the Persian Gulf, the non-Persian oil producing infrastructure. You know, Donald Trump was given the option of bombing Iran back in, I think, 2020, when the Iranians shot down a Global Hawk drone over the Straits of Hormuz. But he was told by the Pentagon that if you do bomb Iran, then there could be escalation that leads to a major conflict, and the United States doesn't have sufficient military forces in the region to guarantee an outcome. And it would take months, if not years, to assemble that force, and even then you couldn't guarantee an outcome. This is why Donald Trump didn't bomb Iran. We will not attack Iran today for the same reason, because we don't have forces sufficient enough to sustain an attack capable of deterring or preventing additional Iranian muscle flexing. If we were to bomb Iran, then Iran would shut down the Strait of Hormuz and attack all major American military facilities in the region, and there'd be nothing we can do to prevent that. And so it would expand into a broader conflict where we would be firing cruise missiles, you know, dropping bombs. But Iran is not defenseless. There are protections. And then what happens? They shoot down a couple American airplanes. Now they have a couple American prisoners of war. You know, we launch an amphibious attack on the Iranian coast. It gets defeated. We have thousands dead. I mean, this is the circle of violence that hopefully the people close to Joe Biden are advising him will occur. And therefore, you shouldn't attack Iran, because we know what the outcome will be: a broader war that the United States can't win.
In your opinion, with what we've seen so far in Gaza, what was the outcome of this conflict for Netanyahu and his administration and his party in Israel?
Strategic defeat across the board. Understand that Netanyahu and his government are responsible, solely responsible, for what happened on October 7th, especially from an Israeli point of view. Not only were Israeli forces caught by surprise, but they were defeated by Hamas. And the Israeli response was one that slaughtered hundreds of Israeli citizens. You know, Israel tried to blame it on Hamas, but I think it's clear today that the majority of the Israeli civilians who died on October 7th and 8th died at the hands of the Israeli Defense Force, who are implementing in one degree or another policies consistent with the Hannibal Directive to kill Israelis taken hostage before they can get back into Hamas-controlled territory or terrorist-controlled territory. So he's a failed leader, right? From there, he promised by engaging in an escalation of military might against Hamas in Gaza that he would A, destroy Hamas's military capability to ensure that Hamas could never again carry out an attack that on the scope and scale of what was done on October 7th, and B, to destroy Hamas politically so that Hamas would have no role in whatever the future political leadership of Palestine was. He's failed on both accounts. The Israeli military has been fought to a standstill, in many cases compelled to retreat from territory inside inside the Gaza Strip. The Israelis acknowledge that they've accounted for barely 20% of the tunnels in the Hamas tunnel network, and they haven't defeated the fighters themselves, who continue to resist and kill Israelis. So, you know, from a military standpoint, you know, Hamas continues to exist and continues, therefore, to have the capability of striking Israel on Israeli soil. So Israel lost that fight. Politically, Hamas today is more powerful and popular than they have ever been. If there was an election held amongst the Palestinian people today, Hamas would win hands down. They would win the legislative body. They would win the presidency. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, has all but admitted this. So, you know, where does that leave Netanyahu? He's dealing with the reality here. Hamas has become even stronger politically, and militarily they exist, and there's nothing Israel can do to diminish Hamas from a military standpoint. This is a strategic defeat for Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel.
Scott, we've seen that they attacked a hospital in the West Bank. They said some terrorists were there. When it comes to the West Bank, is there any sort of sovereignty? How do they control this part of Palestine? I don't know if I can call it Palestine or Israel.
Well, I think the West Bank is part of Palestine. When you take a look at the Abraham's Accords and the maps that are published in there, they talk about the Palestinian territory on the West Bank and Gaza Strip united into a nation state, even though it's extremely diminished territories that would be under the control of the Palestinian Authority. The Israelis are occupying an occupying power. You look at the United States, we finally have woken up, and in order to put pressure on Israel, we've talked about sanctioning the illegal settlement actions on the West Bank. Israel doesn't do itself any favors with how it treats the Palestinians there. The murder, it's not an anti-terrorist operation. It was murder. It's a violation of international law. The Israeli military personnel involved should be arrested and prosecuted as war criminals. They assassinated civilians in a hospital who posed no military threat. It doesn't matter that they were at one point in time affiliated with Hamas. They're not under arms. They're in a protected area, in a protected building, in a protected activity, and yet Israel came in and assassinated them in cold blood. This is a war crime of the most vile nature. And, in a perfect world, you'd see the international community rallying against what the Israelis have done. But to be honest, today, most people have forgotten about that assassination already, just as they've forgotten about everything that Israel's done against the Palestinian people, all the dirty details, the 15-year-old girl gunned down while she was on the phone begging for help, the 6-year-old girl calling in for paramedics to rescue her because her parents are dead, her sister's dead. She's hungry and thirsty, but the Israelis killed the paramedics, leaving the 6-year-old girl to die alone in a car. This happens every hour of every day. The international community has turned a blind eye to what the Israelis have done, not just in the West Bank, but in Gaza. And Israel will be condemned by this.
Taking into account the military operation of Israelis in Gaza and the decision of International Criminal Court and the situation of Biden in the United States, considering the upcoming election 2024, which is he's losing the voters because of the conflict in Gaza. Are we getting to the point that we're going to have some sort of ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, I think we're getting to that point. We're not there yet because Benjamin Netanyahu remains in power. I think there's widespread agreement that if there's a ceasefire, then that's the end of Benjamin Netanyahu politically. And so the question isn't about, a ceasefire. The question is about Benjamin Netanyahu. When will he go? Under what conditions? Because that's the solution.
How do you see the picture of Middle East changing during the conflict in Ukraine and right now the conflict in Gaza?
I think Washington would like to keep the Ukrainian conflict and the Palestinian conflict separate and not allow things to get mixed. But overall, what we're looking at is are two situations where the United States is not successfully able to leverage its economic and military power, its diplomatic influence into victory. Russia is winning and will win in Ukraine. There's nothing the United States can do to stop that. And not just Hamas is defeating Israel, but the axis of resistance, the Iranian-led partnership with Hezbollah, with Syria, with Iraq, with Yemen, is emerging as one of the, as the major power in the region. Hamas has defeated Israel. Israel no longer has this aura of invincibility. And the United States has to deal with that. We, have initiated bombing actions against the Houthi to deter the Houthi from shutting down the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. To no effect. The Houthis shrug it off. They don't care. We've bombed Syrian and Iraqi militias, pro-Iranian militias. But in doing so, we violated sovereignty in Iraq to the extent that the Iraqi people are today demonstrating, hundreds of thousands surrounding the American embassy in Baghdad, demanding that the Americans leave. We are in a very weak position. Plan A is not working. And there is no plan B. So I think what we're going to watch unfold before us in real time is the strategic defeat of the United States in Europe and in the Middle East.
When you look at Biden and his position right now, he's much hurting from the war in Ukraine or the conflict in Gaza.
I think the of the two foreign policy questions, it's the situation in Gaza that's hurting him the most. He is a man who has been bought and paid for by the Israeli lobbies, and yet he's in a situation that if he pursues policy that will be supported by the Israeli lobbies, he will probably lose critical voters in critical states. It's already almost a certainty that the Arab American community in Michigan will not support Joe Biden. And Michigan is one of the states that he has to win if he is going to stay in power. And we're going to see a cascading effect like that about the situation in Gaza, especially if the United States continues to endorse ongoing Israeli genocide. On the issue of Ukraine, I think the mainstream media has become accustomed to the reality that Ukraine is going to lose this war, and they're publishing stories which are conditioning the American public to accept the inevitability of this outcome. So I don't think it matters going forward what's happening in Ukraine, unless President Biden seeks to put his presidency on the line and insist that the Congress pass this $60+ billion loan package. If he commits to this in a very aggressive manner, he may get the money, but then he'll lose even worse, because the fact of the matter is right now, Ukraine not having the money provides a very convenient excuse for those who are trying to, you know, get their head around the fact that Ukraine is getting whipped on the battlefront. Say, oh, America didn't provide the money. America abandoned them, et cetera. Well, in America, we don't care. We don't care what the world thinks. If we did, we wouldn't have left Afghanistan. So we're not worried about the consequences of Ukraine being defeated. What we're worried about is the consequences of sending money to Ukraine while there's an unresolved border dispute, where Americans will start to say, why are you funding other nations' security but ignoring our own? And I think that's the direction that this debate will be heading.
If Trump wins, what does it mean for Ukraine and for Gaza?
Well, remember, to say if Trump wins, you're talking about a November election and a January inauguration, January 2025. There won't be a Ukraine then. It won't exist, so it doesn't matter. Trump is not a factor here in this conflict, nor is a factor in the Gaza conflict, because that conflict will be over there. Benjamin Netanyahu can't hold on for very much longer. He's in a very precarious situation, and he's going to have to yield the prime ministership to a successor who can look for a solution. And so, Trump's irrelevant. I think, when he becomes president, these two issues will have been resolved. He'll have to deal with the aftermath, with the consequences of these. And there, I think we know that Trump is very pro-Israel. So I think, it would be interesting to see how Trump deals with a two-state solution. But, Benjamin Netanyahu won't be in power by that time. Whoever's in power maybe will have taken a more moderate position on two states. So we'll see. On Ukraine, Trump has made it clear that, he doesn't support the, bottomless pit that NATO wants to be in when it comes to U.S. taxpayer dollars, that, he doesn't see the need to create a NATO capable of confronting Russia militarily. Trump will be faced with a fait accompli regarding Ukraine, meaning the defeat of the Ukrainian military, political establishment, and the end of Ukraine as we know it. So I think he'll be more focused on NATO, and he's already said that NATO is an outdated alliance, and maybe the United States shouldn't be continuing its participation in it. So I think that would be the greatest outcome, that, Trump will weigh in. He'll be pro-Israeli, he'll be anti-NATO, but the Gaza conflict will be over and the Ukraine conflict will be over as well. So I think Trump is just isn't part of this current discussion.
Is Trump's presidency a threat, an existential threat for NATO?
I think NATO is an existential threat to NATO. It doesn't matter who the president of the United States is. Trump has certain inclinations that are anti-NATO in nature. But remember, he's also schizophrenic on this issue. On the one hand, he speaks of NATO not pulling its weight. On the other hand, he brags about how he got NATO to invest more militarily. So, you know, it's not like we know which direction Trump is going to go when it comes to NATO.